Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello there, and welcome to Streets Ahead, your podcast dedicated to all things cycling and walking in the UK, and we firmly believe beyond. My name's Ned Bolting.
I'm Laura Laker.
And I'm Adam Tranter.
And welcome to this, our 21st episode, which seems unbelievable, really. We are now 21, the age of majority, three times as old as most podcasts live to be, apparently. Didn't know that. And now it's the year of the ox. Didn't know that either. This script, incidentally, isn't written by me, which is why I'm slightly hesitating over reading it. This week, we're talking about roads. That bit I did know. In particular, the news that the government's £27 billion road building fund is facing a legal challenge after the minister overrode officials' calls for a review of the policy's environmental impact. But first, a bit about us. Right, because so far we've treated this podcast a bit like a kind of community radio station, assuming that everybody knows everything about us. But on consultation with some experts, we realised that not everybody may know who we are and why we're talking about them, talking to them about roads and stuff. Some of you may recognise my voice, I guess, if you follow cycling coverage, particularly on ITV, since I've been part of the ITV Tour de France team for a number of years and now commentate on the race. And I said a number of years, it's so long, I don't actually want to admit how long I've been involved. But put it this way, Lance Armstrong was still racing when I started on the Tour de France. And I've written a bunch of books about cycling and other stuff as well. That's me. But Laura, I know who you are a bit, although I don't think we've ever met face to face because we started this during the pandemic. But Laura, in a kind of like amazingly insightful and very marketable 10-second soundbite that's kind of got to zip off the, you know, out into their podcast listeners' ears. Tell everything that they need to know about you.
So I'm Laura Laker. I'm a cycling journalist, also write about walking sometimes. I have been doing it for about 10 years full time, maybe 8-9 years. And just very kind of passionate about transport, about cycling, about the way we move around, about making the environment better, and everything that kind of cycling does for our health and well-being. And that's me.
And also an all-round good egg. And just before we started recording, you've been busily putting out fires on the internet a little bit, haven't you, over the last few days, which has, I'm sure, shredded your nerves a little bit and cost you all sorts of emotional reserves that you're probably running low on.
Yeah, Twitter can be a bit of a harsh place sometimes, but yeah, I guess that's just par for the course.
I don't think we're breaking any news there. Adam, all I've seen of you, I mean, I've known you for quite a long time, but all I've seen of you for the last, during COVID is the rather sort of small looking cubby hole that you tend to do your, is it a small looking cubby? It's just a white wall behind you and a shelf above your head. And that's all that we ever get to see.
No, I converted
the spare room into a little home office, and my wife's got a desk that side as well, because our day job working in Fusion Media is as a communications agency. And I have, I have more space. Maybe I should set that up. I think there is this trend, isn't there, to, I mean, fairly pointless talking about it on a podcast, but there is this trend to have a nice view behind you with books and stuff like that. And actually now a Union Jack flag is the trend, which I haven't
That's
got
disappointing.
Behind me.
It has been noted, your lack of patriotism, Adam.
Yes, I'm sure it has. Yeah. I'm here because I bloody love this stuff, and I kind of recently got into cycling advocacy and trying to kind of bring my communications skills to the table, because I think we have a communications problem in active travel, and that's led me to talk on it, do this. I volunteer as a bicycle mayor in Coventry, and ultimately I just want, you know, my kids can't ride to school, basically. So my motivation is, you know, if they can cycle to school safely, then, you know, it would be partly a job done. And we're so far from that. And that's what kind of motivates me.
What I really like about your story, Adam, is that you've kind of slowly, year on year, you've become less and less about the racing, haven't you? Because as a kid, you were proper. You were decent. You were a GB, am I right? GB junior kind of thing?
No, not that good. I race, and I raced at like a national level. I did a few little races. Did the Isle of Man youth tour. That was great fun.
Produced some great champions down the years. That race
it has yes. I beat once the famous, well known Peter Kenyuk. A road race. I beat him. He finished about 48th. And I finished about 44th, and I was like, I beat Pete Kenneth. This is brilliant. And he'd ridden the National Madison Championships the night before. Then got home at like 3 a.m. and then done this 90-mile road race or something.
Wow.
But I beat him by a couple of places. So yeah, it's not a lot less about racing for me. I've always been wanting to get people on bikes, and I grew up cycling, and that was really a passion of mine. But like, just something clicked 2 or 3 years ago that, you know, we were getting not many more people on bikes, and they were all interested in road cycling and sport, which I love, and that's my background. But the same joy can be achieved from just riding a bike to the shops and riding, you know, to work and all that sort of stuff. And that's what I love now. So I've got a road bike. I don't think I've used it in 3 years, maybe. And I just ride. Yeah, right at the shops, basically.
And what I love about doing this podcast is I can just kick back and kind of not be relied upon to provide anything that's of any tangible use to anyone, really, because I'm just seriously not the expert. It's just my shared interest in the way I live my everyday life and what I kind of think would be better for all of us. But you guys, what I love about doing this is that you guys are really kind of immersed in this day after day after day in the detail of it all. And I just get to ask the kind of the stupid questions about, no, hang on, I don't understand, and all this. And also play the devil's advocate a bit, because over the course of the 21 episodes, you know me by now. One of my big frustrations has been, I almost mention it every episode, that the, you know, breaking out of our echo chamber and trying to access, you know, and occasionally maybe challenge ourselves and our own assumptions, which is invaluable, because I sometimes sense that, if you like, the other side of this argument, people who feel very differently to us, I wonder how self-critical that camp is. And I think that it's incumbent upon us to be, you know, to go the extra mile, so to speak, to make sure that when we suggest a policy or put forward a proposal, it's been well thought through and it's going to be of benefit, you know.
I think that the two sides, which I'm loath to kind of describe it as, but people who want active travel and people who don't and are quite comfortable with the status quo, that kind of made up kind of culture war is, and I'm talking about this quite a lot at the moment, is it is totally made up. It makes really good copy. It makes really good headlines, but the studies, which we should, you know, refer to frequently, shows that, you know, 2/3 of the British population support active travel, and they even support road space reallocation if it means taking space away from drivers. And we know that from looking at other studies around the world that there's roughly we think 60% of the population who are interested but concerned. You know, they have bikes, they want to ride, etc. So the sense check for me is that actually I think most of the population want active travel holistically, but what is delivered and how it is presented and the benefits it gives people needs to be specific and understandable to them, because they're not going to understand traffic evaporation or induced demand or anything like that. And that's what I think we need to really challenge ourselves on, make sure we're just making sense, basically.
Yeah, I think it's important as well to remember that even though while two-thirds of people might support this stuff, there's a kind of third who might support it given the opportunity, or some of that third might support stuff given the opportunity. And it's also about kind of, I guess, bringing people along with you. I've been talking to a couple of people in the last few days about the importance of not just building physical stuff, but kind of helping people to get the confidence to ride, kind of telling them that this is stuff that you can use, and, you know, maybe giving people support for cycles or support for like walking routes or and all of that stuff, because you can tell someone that something's good for them, but actually kind of showing them and helping them to do that is important too, I think, because it is kind of about behavior change, a lot of the stuff that we do.
All right. Brilliant. Listen, these themes constantly arise, don't they? They're part of the messaging, yeah. You know, of how we go about this. It seems to be kind of relevant every single episode, regardless of what we're talking about. What we have said we're going to address in this episode, so let's do that straight away, is the £27 billion that Transport Minister Grant Shapps wants to use to plaster tarmac up and down Britain's green and pleasant land. I think I've drilled down into the detail enough. I think that's probably all you need to know. Laura, what's going on with that? Or Adam, or whoever wants to lead with this, I don't know.
Yeah, so this was originally a £15 billion road building fund back in 2014. Then last year, Rishi Sunak announced that it was going to be £27 billion. Road building is famously a sort of repeated... it's kind of a bit of a stimulus, seen as an economic stimulus. So if you want to stimulate the economy, then you build stuff, and roads is like a really good one. And for a transport minister, you know, you build a big road, you build a tunnel, then you have a kind of legacy. And that's what part of this is about. The government says it's about helping people for longer journeys, because we can't walk and cycle for longer journeys. It's about freight, but it's £27 billion on various road building schemes, including £1.7 billion for a tunnel under Stonehenge. The Lower Thames Crossing, I learned, is a 14.5-mile route which goes under the Thames, and it bypasses the Dartford Crossing, taking like 14 million trips off of the Dartford Crossing every year. It costs of £6 billion for 14.5 miles. But there was a legal challenge.
Laura, is that different from, I think we're going to maybe come on to discuss this later, but is that different from the Silvertown Crossing?
Yeah, it's different.
So another one, two tunnels.
Yeah,
under the
it's
Thames.
Another
more
one.
Crossings.
More crossings, more big tunnels.
Yeah, I know. I had to do a double take as well, because I haven't really. I mean, this is sort of Kent and Essex. So yeah, the Dartford Crossing is really congested, and it's this whole kind of theory that if you build more roads, then you make more space for cars. But we can talk about that in a bit, because it's one of those fallacies about road building. But yeah, it's a whole different crossing, Ned.
Gosh,
that's what I've learned. Very expensive one. Yeah, and the government's argument is that it needs to combat congestion. Cycling and walking can't take on those longer journeys, but the Transport Action Network, which is a campaign group, are seeking a judicial review of this strategy, because they say they realise that Grant Shapps had basically been given some advice by civil servants in the DfT that he needed to review on environmental grounds, but he overrode that advice, and so that's what they are contesting now.
I feel like I'm getting slightly mixed messaging from Grant Shapps.
Yeah.
Would that be a fair assessment?
I think,
sorry, this is a really bad analogy. I was just going to say he's the guy from the fast show in the pub who changes his mind depending on who he's talking to. Oh, yeah, no, we want to get that.
Paul Whitehouse character, wasn't it? He just basically, yes. Laura, he just agreed with whatever the last person said. So there's always two other people who took totally contrary, and it always ended, each episode ended with exactly the same. Paul Whitehouse would just descend into almost like floods of tears when he go, I don't understand. So that's Card Chaps. Yeah, so he flip-flops a bit. Flip-flops.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, I think my understanding is that I think he got a bit of stick last year. There were some local schemes in his area where he's MP that were done that perhaps weren't the best, that he got a lot of kind of lobbying from local constituents over. And he got a bit burned by the Telegraph and the Daily Mail over them and general cycling and walking schemes. But he's being told by Boris Johnson that, you know, we need to build cycling and walking stuff. But he's kind of very conscious of like the kind of need of the motorist, I guess he would see it as, and he kind of sees electric cars as a solution, but has to be reminded of cycling and walking stuff, I think.
Yeah, I think it's you know, the fast show is probably too simplistic an analogy, but it is definitely the politics of compromise. I think, you know, there are, and we should, you know, getting out of our echo chamber, we should accept that there are some incredibly, not just from a lobbying point of view, but just generally, if you ask people on the street what they think, you know, induced demand is not on their radar. If they're sat in traffic and you build an extra lane, that sounds like a good thing. You're giving something to those people. And I think that you have that on one side, but with actually really quite serious ambition from the Prime Minister and his advisor, Andrew Gilligan. And then, you know, we saw this last week. There was a select committee meeting where Grant Shapps was talking to MPs. And, you know, the points raised is, will you be asking people to drive less because your original decarbonising transport forward said, we will use our cars less, as an example. The Committee on Climate Change report, and obviously we've got COP26 this year in the UK, the Committee on Climate Change say that even if vehicles are electric, we will need to reduce mileage by, I think, around 20%. And some other people say it's got to be even more than that. I don't think anyone's like saying really strongly, oh, we should get lorries off the road, or, you know, people shouldn't be able to drive to go and see their aunt 90 miles away. I think what we're saying is that, you know, 50% 50% of journeys, over 50% of journeys are between 1 and 2 miles and taken by car. So they're the easy wins that are potentially swappable.
Playing devil's advocate here, or just, you know, trying to test our opposition to this big spend. There must be some truth to the argument that building a road in the right place can be of economic benefit to a region. If you think, for example, of Hull City, without the M62 reaching across Yorkshire and connecting it with Leeds and Sheffield, it would be very isolated, and presumably that through flow of traffic that makes it accessible is of economic benefit to Hull.
Yeah, it's beneficial for people to be able to reach places, obviously, but I think the way that we calculate the value of roads is quite skewed. So there's the tool that the government uses to calculate the value of infrastructure schemes places the value of a driver's time, for example, highly, and places the value of other users like train users, cyclists, pedestrians, all a lot lower. And so any delays to motorists is seen as a cost, and any delays to other users is like less of a cost. And so when you're looking at economic arguments, it's kind of skewed in favour of driving. So there is obviously an economic benefit for people to be able to get from place to place, but how you do that is kind of a political choice to an extent.
It also depends on what you spend that money on. So, for example, if you were to build, so, and we're having this conversation at the moment, I guess, in public about HS2 and also Northern Rail, like the Northern element of rail, you know, saying, well, it takes, you know, an hour and a half to get from Manchester to Leeds or whatever by train. And obviously there are lots of, you know, city to city motorways that do that job, but we've not invested in that part of the infrastructure at all. So what we find is it's very accessible by car, but that perpetuates the prob- And we're also not measuring, as Laura says, we're measuring car drivers as more important than other people who use other modes of transport, literally by the amount they're worth per minute delayed. But also we're not,
we're not counting. I think you're going to say we're not counting the health disbenefits of driving.
Yes, Laura, we're not. So we're measuring the time it takes and the cost of that, but we're not measuring the health benefits or like how people feel about their society. And also the, you know, Peter Walker's new book, you know, shows that the NHS cost the NHS of inactivity, for example, something like £7 billion a year, and 100,000 premature deaths are related to inactivity each year as well. So we're not having those discussions, and that's because the way that our transport system is built is of a certain, you know, certain era.
Yeah, so going back to the politics of this, where does that leave this spend? And so there's a challenge, but is that really expected to succeed? And you know, if it doesn't, what are the consequences? What are the potential ways of questioning this policy that are still open to those who don't feel it's like it's terribly progressive?
Where it's at the moment is the same group, Transport Action Network, who put a successful legal challenge to the Heathrow third runway plans, have put this forward. There's a definite way to go. There's a lot of legal proceedings and wranglings to happen. And actually, to, you know, just for the interest of balance, you know, the Department of Transport did make a case, or somebody at least made the case that Grant Shapps is, you know, entitled as the Secretary of State to make these decisions. And you know, he's there to make decisions when they're, you know, when they're tough, and even if they are against some of the advice that has had. Ministers do this all the time. So I'm not saying it's right by any means, but that there's a long way to go. And actually, we've seen appeal after appeal with these things as well. So it's never quite that straightforward. You can have a win originally, and then, you know, on appeal under different grounds, it can be rejected. So there's a hell of a long way to go in this, but it is, I think, raising the discussion, which will be what potentially concerns the government. You know, Boris Johnson's 10-point green plan and all of these things, again, leading to COP26, having the world's media on your doorstep, and you, while you're talking about how much you're going to build on roads and other things, is not a good look. So that's going to be one of the sticks as well, I think. To play devil's advocate to myself, I think, and to not Ned's changing his batteries, by the way, which is why I'm playing devil's advocate to myself in the absence of a co-host. I would say that I've seen only on Twitter. I don't know the full details, but guess who else is building loads of roads at the moment?
Me?
It's
no.
The Dutch. It's the Dutch. The Dutch have got a massive road building plan. And, you know, often highlighted as the cycling utopia, of which it rightly is. And they are building tons and tons of roads. And that leads me to the kind of devil's advocate point is, and this is happening locally to me right now, is road building a necessary evil to get with a program if it enables active travel at the same time? From a climate point of view, I don't think that's the case. But if we are building these new roads, a lot of them are being suggested that they will have active travel facilities as part of the building. So that's opening up new routes. But ultimately, I'm locally left with a position now is, and I tell you what I've done, I've objected, but I could back a £70 million dual carriageway because we're going to get a cycle lane as well. Or I can say, guys, you're really not going along this the right way. You need to look at active travel first and public transport first. And if that's not solving your problems, then look at road building.
And I can vouch for having to drive around Amsterdam's ring road at rush hour, and it's absolute hell. You know, it's like the M25 on steroids. Mm. So it can be an awful, congested nightmare. Now, I can well believe, I mean, you know, they're very motor, you know, outside of their completely different attitude towards getting around the towns and cities in which they live, and indeed the rural communities in which they live, which are all quite interconnected. Outside of that, they're as wedded to the motor car, yeah. I would suggest, well, as any other Western European.
They own more cars, yeah, per head than we do in the UK.
But yet they've managed to evolve the two ecosystems in tandem.
Yeah.
And that's something that we just haven't managed to do. But it's a slightly more, it's an interesting take, isn't it? It's not something you hear very often. In fact, I've not heard that about their road building program until you just mentioned it now, Adam.
They've got some of the most satisfied drivers in the world, though, apparently, the Dutch.
Really? That is great, aren't they? Got the happiest kids, satisfied drivers. Oh, hi there, I'm very satisfied.
Talking of which, did you see the video that did the rounds yesterday of, you know, all the canals froze over?
Oh,
in the
ice skating fail.
The guy in the pants skates, yeah, just wearing his pants, and he goes through the ice, and you think, oh, blimey. Yeah, just skating in his underpants, Laura. It's a good video.
And he found the ice.
Won't spoil it for you. Great. He fell on the ice and got cold. That's the story.
Because he was just wearing his pants. That's it.
This local problem that we have, it's a dual carriageway to Warwick University, and in many respects, you know, has some merit. There's talks of very light rail, you know, to be connecting up, and a new public transport hub. Of course, none of that stuff's funded. And the thing that they can be sure of is this tons of money that there are for dual carriageways. And I got a bit exasperated this week, and I wrote my response to consultation, and just the first couple of lines, because I think it's relevant to this, said, in 1955, urban planning specialist Lewis Mumford said, building more roads to prevent congestion is like loosening your belt to cure obesity. In 2021, I'm responding to a consultation that proposes to build a new road to relieve congestion. So on. And it's just getting boring now, because every time, like, what works? Build another lane. What works? Oh, maybe we could build another lane. It's like, guys, we've been trying this since the 40s and 50s, and it's still not enough. Maybe we could, like, realize that it's not something that can go forever. We have to make a stop at some point.
Yeah, I think this is just a kind of product of the way that we kind of value infrastructure schemes, though. There was a case in Oxfordshire, I think it was the year before last, there's been this campaign for the B4044 cycle path for like a decade. And they've got the most incredible campaigners. They're so dedicated. They produced a video showing why a cycle lane was needed on this winding B road. It's like looks super dangerous to cycle on. There's like a verge. They did all sorts of surveys. They paid like 20 grand for these surveys to be done to kind of make the case for this cycle lane. And you just think, if these people can't do it with all of this kind of drive that they have and all of these skills and you know, who can do it? Anyway, there's a new housing estate going to be built at one end of this road. And then the road kind of links with Oxford. And so they're like, well, great, this is our chance to get the funding for the cycle lane to link the new housing estate up. And they had to remove the cycle lane from the funding bid because it would have harmed the business case for the whole of the scheme.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and it's heartbreaking. And I think the day that the funding got announced, the day that the funding got announced, the postman was killed cycling on this road. And it's just, you know, like the horrificness of it. But it was impossible to do anything but kind of the road in this case. So you can kind of understand from a council point of view, if this is the messaging that they're getting. And there were sort of letters to and from, it was when Jesse Norman was cycling minister, letters to and from him, and he was saying, you can do it. But then he was getting mixed messages, and in the end they couldn't. So yes, that's the situation.
I mean, in terms of opposing policy and activism and all that sort of thing and its pitfalls and its difficulties, I think it's really interesting, Laura. I was, I can't remember who I was hearing on the radio, talking about combating, what's it called, vaccine hesitancy.
Yeah. Mm.
And saying that you shouldn't overestimate how much impact you can have by simply explaining things, you know, explaining the safety, explaining efficacy
and its importance, because actually, ultimately, with a lot of vaccine hesitancy, people make decisions emotionally rather than rationally. And I think in some ways, I think we probably all would agree that nobody really likes roads. I mean, you'd have to be pretty weird to like the idea of tarmacking the nation. You know, it doesn't seem like a very good idea. But what you shouldn't underestimate is quite how much we like cars. Yeah. You know, I mean, I think they are emotionally, you know, you only need to think of the way that they've been advertised in the past. I remember when I was a kid, or rather growing up, that advert of the, I think it was a type of Volkswagen or something, in which the father of the, you know, he transported his precious young daughter in this safe, perfect environment. And, you know, that kind of plays to that. I can't remember which brand of car it was, but the interior of cars are designed by very clever people to be wonderful spaces that are to feel terrifically empowering. Mm. You know, this immense and unnecessary power sensitive to like the slightest pressure with your right foot. And the way the dashboard lights up and provides you with all this information, now the comfort of the seat. You know, I have this theory, particularly in this country, where a lot of people live in the cities in quite substandard housing. Yeah. And a lot of the places we live in are pretty kind of inadequate in lots of ways. Mm. But for a relatively affordable price, most people can have parked outside their house this box that contains all this magic and can not only feel a nice place to sit, but can take you pretty damn fast from A to B most of the time. Yeah. And so that is something that, good. We all understand the magic of getting out and, you know, riding away your troubles, even in the sub-zero temperatures we've had on a bike. But that's not an immediately obvious attraction, whereas everybody kind of gets. And if we're honest with ourselves, we can kind of understand the... We were actually in our WhatsApp group, weren't we? We were talking about this just the other day because...
We've been closet drivers I used to drive... My wife always picks me up on this. If I ever get too big my boot, she goes, just remember, when we lived in Ealing, you used to drive a mile to your like local office. And I did. I had parking at the office, I had parking at home. Mm-hmm. And I just drove a mile and didn't think anything of it. And I didn't think about how it would harm people that made other choices. I didn't think about how I added to congestion. I didn't think about the cost. I didn't think about any of these things. And, you know, that I feel like I'm in a more informed position now. And I wasn't a bad person then. And, you know, I was just a victim of the planning decisions that have been made around me. And I just didn't know about this stuff. Why would I?
I think you make a really compelling point, Ned, and I think it's totally right. It does really appeal to people, and it's supposed to. And a car is such a kind of item of freedom, isn't it? And
Laura, it's time for you maybe to admit to
I'm building up to
the photograph. Yeah. The photograph in your collection.
I've got this awful photograph. So I had my head shaved when I was 17. I had a bad haircut, and on a whim, I got my sister's boyfriend at the time to shave it all off. I got like a grade 5 or something, and I basically didn't look in the mirror for a year. But unfortunately, this photograph in question is during that year where I had awful hair. It went to sort of a mullet stage. But then anyway, my first car was this brown Fiesta, Mark 1 Fiesta. It was dreadful. And I've got a picture of me hugging it, basically. Yeah, so I'm kind of...
Laura, can you send that to us and I'll put it as the artwork for the podcast?
No, I don't even know. I was clearing up some drawers and I found it and I was like, Jesus, this is such a bad picture of me in so many ways. But yeah, I totally love my car because we were in the middle of nowhere. I grew up in the middle of nowhere. We were in Somerset. And if you didn't have a car, you couldn't get places. Before that, I used to hitchhike. I was hitching everywhere. And it's kind of a bit dangerous. It's very inconvenient. You never know when you're going to get anywhere. The buses are dreadful. So when you get your car, it really is. It is actual freedom. Oh. So, yeah. And I used to love driving. I did. I don't have a car now, but... I did used to love it, and I can totally understand why it's so appealing, because you could just go anywhere. You could just like pick up and go.
I think there's probably a compromise here, and I think it's a nuance, and there'll be people that just totally don't agree with this, but I think we accept that driving is always going to be a thing to a certain level, but that we need people to think about the impact that it has when they drive, but also we need to give people the the dignity of choice. You know, at the moment, we're not providing a transport system that allows people to make a choice. And it's not about being, you know, it's very quickly, you know, oh yeah, you're anti-car. But I think we should have some rules, really, where car, and some agreement and some leadership from government about where cars should and shouldn't go. I think there's a general consensus from at least transport professionals that cars do not belong in cities and city centres and have a negative impact on the economy even, and just health and all of those things. So why not, you know, why not build a kind of, yeah, a compromise leadership position of we're going to build roads, but we're going to spend them building where we can make a difference to communities, and we're going to build active travel as part of that. And we're also going to spend, we're going to spend £12 billion of that resurfacing roads, and everyone can unite behind potholes. It's a politically safe subject matter. Potholes. I'm not saying this is exactly where I'm at, because it's not. It jars me a little bit. But in the interests of progress, you know, I think this zero-sum game is not going to help many people, and it's not going to potentially help us get more cycle networks.
I was just thinking before this podcast, actually, before we move on, about how many phrases we have with road in it. Just like road is quite a symbolic thing. It's like journeys, it's getting places, it's progress. And I think there is something
driving
about
this as well. My my local museum, the Coventry Transport Museum, changed their slogan rather a couple of years ago. And given it's the transport museum of the city that invented the modern bicycle, the slogan is driving change. And I was like,
there's a whole linguistic rabbit hole we could disappear down there, and kind of if we broaden it out to Latin languages and Germanic languages, and how the act of propelling yourself on a bicycle in most Germanic languages is derived from the equivalent of driving, whereas in French it's running.
Oh, really?
So un coureur, un corredor, un coureur. That's to run, because that's the origins of the bike, isn't it? It's a fast way of walking, velociped, you know. But that's of no interest here.
I'm
is it?
Interested. I think that's very interesting, personally.
Maybe we could fill a whole hour with it later. But before we close off today's episode, in our bid to make all the production values of this, you know, responding to our listeners' feedback, our production raising the whole bar and that, Adam, you edit this podcast. Right now, I want you to drop in the jingle, if that's the right way of describing it, the supports an irregular new slot that we have in which we bring you up to date with all the latest LTN news. That's London Transport News, and it's got its own jingle.
Live from the Streets Ahead newsroom, it's LTN.
All right, so that was brilliant. That was really well done. I haven't actually heard it because it'll only be done in the edit later, but I'm assuming it was brilliant. Laura, you are LTN. You're basically the Streets Ahead LTN SAR, whether you like it or not. And you need to tell us what's been going right and maybe also what's been going wrong on the latest. Well, it's the front line of the culture war, isn't it? Let's put it
that
way.
Yeah, it kind of is, isn't it? Yeah, it's been quite divisive. So my local area has got new LTNs, for one thing, they were introduced yesterday as we record, and I think that's like the fourth or fifth one that they've introduced now in my area, without too much trouble, and following the legal challenge from the Licensed Taxi Drivers Association regarding equalities impact assessment of cycle schemes, they've worked much more closely with groups representing people with disabilities on new schemes, which is really good outcome, I think, from that. And I think on a forthcoming episode, we're going to talk about that a bit more if we can get hold of the people that we need. There was also Cycling UK submitted FOIs to ambulance trusts and asked them to identify any active travel schemes that were introduced without consultation, any that had caused emergency response delays, and any that had outstanding problems relating to such schemes, and whether they supported them. The results came back from the ambulance trust generally supportive. There hadn't been any problems that hadn't been resolved. There wasn't stuff being introduced without their knowledge. A lot of them had input with councils on their designs. So a lot of them came back saying they were supportive of these measures. You know, it wasn't just LTNs, it was cycle lanes. And I think Cycling UK's focus was on cycle lanes. And just saying that these measures basically, because they make cycling and walking safer, that they support them, efforts to reduce air pollution, efforts to reduce car use, all of that. So, yeah, generally, it seems like the emergency response news is good. I think there are sort of schemes still being pulled out, unfortunately. I know that my neighbouring borough, Redbridge, pulled one out a couple of months ago, which is sad. That's on the quiet way that runs near me, actually. The end of the quiet way, which is no longer as quiet since that went. But yeah, it's a very patchy picture still, but some boroughs pressing ahead and some are not.
Grounds of the opposition to LTNs seems to shift occasionally.
Yeah, a little bit.
A lot of video gets shared of kind of ambulance. I say a lot. I've seen the odd sort of video of ambulance drivers jumping out and fiddling around with keys.
Yeah.
To try and access a road which is something, to be fair, Laura, that I remember when we first started talking about these things, I was quite kind of puzzled as to how that might work.
I think that ambulance drivers do encounter delays from schemes. There weren't any in particular identified by any of the trusts for the article that I wrote on this FOI, although there have been issues reported in, I think, Ealing. I think basically they work with the councils and kind of resolve these issues. Ambulance drivers are very skilled at getting around, and it's just about whether they've often got quite old navigational systems. So sometimes they're not updated.
Be really careful with this one, because it seems on the face of it indefensible, doesn't it? You know, your immediate reaction when you see somebody clearly being held up by having to unlock is you know, well, this has got to go. Mm. On the other hand, how many times have you been sitting in a car, maybe driving a car, and behind you, you're trying to work out where that ambulance is that's coming up behind you that is stuck in traffic and being delayed in congested roads? You know, that's never considered in the same light, is it?
You know?
There weren't many campaigns to stop that from happening. You know, we seem quite comfortable with congestion generally. And the impact it has, and also a lot of people that are giving these comments in favour, you know, they're healthcare professionals. They see the bigger picture as well. They understand that, you know, the NHS and their, for even frontline services, have to spend an inordinate amount of time because of things like air quality and inactivity and things that go along with that, you know, road collisions, diabetes and inactivity, all of those things. What I did see, I think, Ned, you said this before, but we were talking about Twitter, and you were saying, you know, let's engage with people on Twitter if we feel like there's a way to, you know, have a discussion and change their mind. And if you're not going to, then you're wasting energy. And I found this with, you know, some campaigners I've had quite good conversations with, and I've seen their point of view. And other campaigners, you know, you say about ambulances, for example, they say, well, you can't block ambulances, and say, okay, what we'll do is we'll put cameras in then. You can't find motorists. You know, there's always an answer. There's a flow chart of responses. And the summary is they don't want any change. You know, they don't have any answers of how to solve air quality and how to get more people cycling and walking.
No one likes change, do they?
But you can see very clearly those who have a huge passion for, you know, there are people that have a real passion for air quality who don't believe in LTNs. And I think we should have a discussion about that. And then there's ones that are kind of using quite bizarre and horrible tactics to do that.
Well, one thing that occurred to me just going for a walk around my neighbourhood, as I think we were all doing a lot of that kind of thing, aren't we? But, you know, LTNs aren't new.
No.
Around the Victorian streets where I live, there's evidence, God knows when it all happened, but decades ago, residential roads were blocked off.
Yeah.
Or blocked, you know, either by pedestrianising, putting pavement at the end that literally block it off, or occasionally concrete bollards, or those big metal gates with a padlock.
Yeah, big metal gates that say fire access on them. We've had them for decades.
There are a surprising amount of them that I've just taken for granted in my neighbourhood and never, and only looking at them now because it strikes me that all they are is LTNs, really.
Yeah.
And people have just got used to them, you know.
There's loads of them.
And by and large, they're a good thing. Yeah. You know, I'm sure they're appreciated by the residents of the roads that, you know, are blocked off from through traffic.
Yeah. Yeah, I did a little article on them last year for Mind the Zag, the website. And I looked into a few of them. Some in Leicester, Hackney famously. Merton's got a bunch. Heptonstall is a small West Yorkshire town. Where Sylvia Plath is buried, that's like no through traffic. Loads of them.
LTN news wasn't quite as snappy as we were hoping this short segment.
I know, it started so well with that jingle that we haven't yet heard.
But I had a policy idea because of how concerned everyone is about response times for ambulances and fire engines. We should mandate that double cycle tracks are built on every single road, so there is an express lane for emergency vehicles to use at any time. And when there aren't emergency vehicles using it, we can let cyclists use it.
Brilliant. Because that seems to be everyone's concern, doesn't it? That ambulances need free access. So I think that's a clever policy suggestion. All right then, snappily, should we leave it there for this episode? Well, I thought we all shone. I thought, you know, everyone knows about us now as kind of individuals and humans, which is obviously, it's going to propel us from, well, Adam, we're apparently in the top 2% of all podcasts in the world, yeah?
Apparently, so, yeah. We had a podcast MOT done for us, which is why we're acting like weirdos trying to be popular. and one of the things it said is, well done. You're in the top 2% of podcasts in the world. And that's great, but we could do better, and that's what we are attempting to do.
God, if that's us trying to do better, God help us. Anyway, we are in the top 2% because of you listening, so thank you very much, and I hope you do continue listening to Streets Ahead. Do let us know what you think at Pod Streets Ahead is our handle, and rate and review us online, and please share the podcast with anyone you think might enjoy it. And do contact us, by the way, if you have any suggestions for what you want to see discussed, or whether you, like Adam, have got any cracking policy ideas, because we'd like to hear from about those as well. And in the meantime, from Adam, from Laura, and from myself, it's goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.